We're examining America's complex and often opaque parole system, and we're doing that through the story of one man, convicted murderer Jacob Weidman. He's at the center of a new series called Violation from WBUR and the Marshall Project. This week, as reporter Beth Schwartzapfel picks up the story, Jake has gotten married while in prison to a woman named Martha De Soto, and after 30 years behind bars for murdering Eric Kane, Jake Weidman is finally granted parole.
Let's rewind to November of 2016, when Jake was released from prison to home arrest. He moved into a halfway house in Phoenix. The vibe was sort of like a cross between a drug rehab and a college dorm, designed to ease the transition to the outside world. He had his own room, but there was a curfew and mandatory meetings and a manager who kept an eye on things.
I can't believe this, you know, and I'll be spending the night tonight, not in a cell, but in an actual bedroom, and I'll get to see my wife tonight and give her a hug outside, you know, without being monitored by some visitation officers.
Now, home arrest is meant to be like you're incarcerated at your house. Arizona law says it's conditioned on remaining at the inmate's place of residence at all times, except for movement out of the residence according to mandated conditions. But for a long time, the corrections department treated it more like a trial run, letting people earn a little freedom and watching closely. If they did well, they could move on to general parole, which would mean no ankle monitor and fewer restrictions. Even though he was still technically a prisoner, Jake was as free as he had been in decades. I keep trying to think about how to characterize the wonder and grace he says he felt at all the little things he experienced his first night there. How overwhelmed and awed he was by being able to walk out a door without permission. How he couldn't sleep that first night because he hadn't spent the night in a room that was quiet and dark for 30 years. After writing and discarding half a dozen cheesy metaphors, I figure I'll just let Jake tell you about it.
One of the most beautiful moments of my life was sitting outside at a little picnic table right in front of the halfway house in the evening, watching the sunset with my wife, eating dinner, eating dinner out of a little cardboard box.
Jake looked out at the mountains in the distance and remembered all the times Marta had described her hikes in those mountains to him over the phone, how long he had dreamed of joining her, and how he hoped that soon he'd be able to do that.
And tears came to my eyes. For a little while, I couldn't stop crying. And it's funny because most of the guys at the halfway house, they're former prisoners and, still kind of caught up in the taboos about showing vulnerability and things like that. So even in that moment of utter freedom and utter emotional freedom, I'm still trying to, put my elbow next to my face.
Decades of prison culture were so ingrained that he wasn't yet ready to show his tears. Later that night, Marta went home and Jake went to his room.
And suddenly, Eric came to mind. And the only thing I could think of was, or imagine in that moment was just to repeat over and over again like a mantra, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry,
Jake says he often thinks of Eric. He says that part of his daily routine when he wakes up each morning is to bring Eric and his family to mind, to wish them peace, and to recommit to being his best self in honor of the pain he caused them. But although he thinks of Eric every day, Jake says this moment was different.
Thinking of Eric after the surpassing joy that I had felt for the last couple of hours that I just described, and I felt like there was a part of me which just felt like he belonged there too. How could I have taken the opportunity from another human being to experience what I just experienced. And I just had that kind of communing with Eric's spirit where I just, you know, said, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
If you're wondering about Jake's authenticity here, I mean, he gets emotional so rarely in our interviews. You might be asking, does Jake wake up every day thinking about Eric? What does being truly sorry sound like? These are not things I can fact check. For their part, Eric's family did not appear to believe that Jake was sorry or trust that he had changed. Almost immediately after Jake's release, Eric's father, Sandy Kane, contacted the parole office. He wanted to ask a few questions and, quote, provide you with some important information that could be helpful to you in managing this case, the record said. It's because of his status as a victim that Sandy Kane could make a call like this. Arizona is a leader in victims' rights protections. It was only the sixth state to enshrine a victim's Bill of Rights into its state constitution, which, among other things, ensures that any time a defendant has a right to appear and speak, their victim, or in a murder case, their victim's family, does too. That includes every appearance from a sentencing hearing all the way to a parole board hearing decades later. The statute doesn't say they can call and talk to any corrections official at any time. It also doesn't say they can't. I've spoken to many people who work in the system in Arizona, and they all say officials tend to err on the side of providing victims access, even when the rules don't specifically require it.
So there are situations where, because of the victim's concerns and the victim's needs, they will reach out to the parole officers, etc.
Mariam El Menshawi directs the Victims of Crime Resource Center at the University of the Pacific in California. She said the system's attention to victims was born of the victims' rights movement, which took shape in the 1980s.
The innocent victims of crime have frequently been overlooked by our criminal justice system, and their pleas for justice have gone unheeded, and their wounds, personal, emotional, and financial, have gone unattended.
That's Ronald Reagan talking about a task force he convened in 1982. For many decades, with the state and the defendant on opposite sides of a case, the victim was a sort of third wheel. All these people talking about something terrible that happened to them, without their voice mattering at all. Reagan's task force called the treatment of victims a national disgrace and urged states to pass a wide range of new protections. The right to be heard was one of them, Mariam said.
If the person's out on parole, they want to make sure that the person doesn't come, you know, close to where they live, close to where they work. So they want to make sure that there's a GPS monitor on that person and that it is being followed. Sometimes victims reach out to parole officers regarding restitution. So, they can reach out to the probation office or the parole officer to let the probation officer know, hey, this person's not paying.
But the Kane's degree of involvement with officials was unusual for a victim's family. Over the course of Jake's time out of prison, the Canes were regularly in touch with the Department of Corrections, calling them, emailing them, with complaints, with information, with their own reports about Jake's whereabouts. The Canes did their own investigation of Jake and submitted it to corrections officials. And Jake's experience in the system of mass supervision was about to change. Around the same time that Sandy Kane was expressing his outrage that Jake was out of prison, the director of the department personally began holding meetings to ensure that the parole office was properly supervising Jake, even though his own employees said Jake was following all the rules. This is a man who was, at the time, overseeing 10 state prison complexes, 6 private prisons, and thousands of employees. I talked to many experts who work in and around the corrections department, and they all said this is not what usually happens. This is John Fabricius.
I'm the executive director of Arizona for Transparency and Accountability in Corrections, ATAC, here locally in Arizona.
He was incarcerated for 15 years in Arizona prisons and later went on to found a Department of Corrections watchdog group in the state. He said this about victims' usual involvement in parole cases he's observed.
You're going to go through victim services and you're going to go through the normal bureaucracy and they're going to be responsive to you, but you're certainly not going to get the director of the Department of Corrections setting meetings, following up and bringing in people and, you know, doing all the things that...
Since I started telling you Jake's story and reporting it out, There's always been this question of whether the Caines have been too involved in Jake's parole case, pushing the boundaries of how parole works. Because there are ways in which Jake's case feels very unusual in the way it has played out. But you can't really blame the Caines for being persistent and as involved as possible with the effort to keep Jake in prison. They were shocked that Jake was released and wanted to make sure the state was keeping a very close eye on the person who murdered their son.
Reporter Beth Schwartzapfel with an excerpt from the new podcast series, Violation. It's from WBUR and the Marshall Project. Next week, you'll hear how the victim's family goes to great lengths to get Jake back into prison. We're airing full episodes of the show every Friday on our podcast, Here and Now, anytime. You can find it wherever you listen.